On 104.5 FM, this is WRFU LP Urbana. It's 6 p.m. on Thursday, and time for A Critical Ear, presented by Andrew O'Boyle and Robert Naiman. And we're starting this week's edition of A Critical Ear, as we usually do, with the Panos London Institute news bulletin for today, the 7th of August 2008. Mauritania's one-year civilian government has been toppled in a bloodless military coup. Soldiers arrested the northwest African country's first freely elected leader, President Sidi Ould Cheikh Abdali, and shut down radio and television stations on Wednesday. A state council has been formed to run the sprawling desert nation. The coup has been widely condemned, with the United Nations and African Union demanding the return of the constitutional government. Rising political tension in the country had recently led the president to sack four army commanders who then staged the coup. The military has been involved in nearly every government in Mauritania. President Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan faces the prospect of impeachment after ruling coalition parties agreed in principle to begin proceedings. Officials say a charge sheet outlining the president's position and performance will be prepared in a move expected to reignite political turmoil. The impeachment question had threatened to divide Pakistan's governing coalition. Musharraf had previously said he would rather resign than face impeachment. He has so far resisted pressure to quit since his political allies were defeated in February elections. President Musharraf seized power in a military coup in 1999. Under the constitution, the president retains the power to dissolve parliament. A cholera outbreak on a remote island in the Philippines has killed 21 people, many of them children. A local Red Cross official said 60 others had been taken to hospital. The disease broke out more than a week ago among Manobo tribesmen in an isolated area on the island of Mindanao. It took the Red Cross 9 hours to reach the area. Poor sanitation has been blamed for the outbreak. Hundreds of people have demonstrated in the streets of the Venezuelan capital Caracas against plans to ban nearly 300 mostly opposition politicians from standing for election. Riot police fired tear gas at the protesters. The demonstrators say President Hugo Chavez is concentrating more power in his hands through the ban. Politicians blacklisted by the government stand accused of various misdemeanors in public office. None of them has been convicted of any crime. The ban has since been upheld by the Supreme Court. Regional and local elections are scheduled to be held in 4 months' time. A new study has shown that Brazil now has more middle-class than poor people for the first time in its history. More than half of the country's 190 million people live in middle-class families, defined as having monthly revenues of between $750 and $3,200. The data was collected by Brazil's Applied Economic Research Institute. The shrinking poor population is attributed to economic growth, a rising minimum wage, and policies to encourage family farming. However, an estimated 11 million Brazilians still live below the poverty line. A new census has shown that an estimated 125,000 endangered Western lowland gorillas are living in the Republic of Congo. Researchers say this is double previous estimates. The census data was released by the Wildlife Conservation Society during the International Primatological Society's Congress in Edinburgh. Researchers did not spot any gorillas in the latest census, but based their estimates on the gorilla nests they had found. Each gorilla makes a nest from leaves and branches to sleep in at night. Researchers attributed the increased numbers to successful long-term conservation management in the Congo, a food-rich habitat, and the remote location. Interworld Radio headlines are provided by Interworld Radio, the daily news and feature service from the Panos Institute, London. More information at www.panos.org.uk and www.interworldradio.net. Views expressed on A Critical Ear are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Centre, or Urbana Socialist Forum. Feedback is welcome at show@acriticalear.info. More information at acriticalear.info. And we're back in studio with me, as usual, Bob Naiman. Good afternoon, Bob.
As typically.
Today we're starting with an issue that's kind of come to the fore in the election campaign here in the US, the presidential election, issue of energy dependence, offshore drilling, and so on. This week, you got into a rather unusual debate. you took on the energy policy plan of Paris Hilton in what was a bold and brave move on your part, taking on the detailed plan. Give our listeners, those who have missed the internet meme, a little bit of background.
Well, two rivers flow together. One is that we're having a national debate, in some ways ridiculous national debate, about energy policy. I say in some ways ridiculous because, obviously, it's been a big shock to many Americans that gas is now $4 a gallon. By European standards, that's not a big deal, but it's a big change that people in the United States have experienced over the last several years. And many people made life choices that were based on gas being much cheaper, you know, like what automobile they bought and drive, where they live, you know, maybe far from public transportation, maybe far from their jobs.
And I should say one of the differences between, you know, coming from Europe, where Ireland has, I think, you know, second or third highest oil prices, some of that a factor of being a small island nation and prices going up, but a large portion of it being in Europe, taxation policy, taxation, high levels of taxation on oil, which, again, here in the US, there is a tax on oil, but a relatively low one,
yes,
which gives the government little room to decide, you know, to move away from that should they choose to try to control that way, whereas in Europe there is more flexibility if high oil prices are a concern.
Well, partly because the big part of the price that the consumer faces is government taxation. So that means that fluctuations in the price of a barrel of oil have less of an impact mm-hmm. on, you know, it actually dampens the fluctuation in the price that consumers face. Depending on how the tax is done. But in any event, so many people in the U.S., in some ways quite understandably, when you consider the very rough transition, I mean, the fact that this is a failure of government policy to allow this huge swing to take place, wouldn't have been a huge swing if there had been proactive government policy earlier. But now people have experienced this huge swing. It's a lot of hardship for poor people who live in small towns that are far away from jobs. And so the Republicans are now, you know, Senator McCain and congressional Republicans are engaging in this, right-wing populist demagogue move of demanding that Congress lift the ban on most offshore drilling. Senator McCain actually formally supported the ban, just another way to see what an opportunist move this is. But another way to see how opportunist a move this is the fact that the government's, the United States federal government's Energy Information Administration, which is in fact the U.S. government agency that's charged with the tasks of producing analysis, nonpartisan, supposed to be nonpartisan objective analysis for evaluating energy policies. They have produced an analysis that says that lifting this ban will not have any impact on gas prices. It'll have zero impact for like the next 10 years because it'll take that long for the oil production to come online. But even then, they project that at its peak, the production from these offshore wells would be 200,000 barrels a day. And, of course, well, I tell you 200,000 barrels a day and you don't know anything about the oil market, that's a meaningless number. That would be, according to their projection, 0.2%, 0.2% of world production at its peak. The contrary to a lot of the nonsense that people promulgate, there is one global market in oil. You want to try and bring down the price of oil, that's the market you have to affect. So if you're going to try to reduce the price of gas by increasing production, you have to increase world production. That's the market you have to affect. The Energy Information Administration says that 200,000 barrels a day is not going to affect adding 0.2% to world production is not going to affect the price. And in any event, this effect is not going to happen for 10 years. So to tell people, oh yeah, we have a plan to do something about the gas price you face, we're going to lift the ban on offshore drilling, that's total 100% nonsense. And the only way you could get anyone to go for that is if they're A, ignorant, and B, you know, kind of desperate. So the ignorant part is that people don't know the facts that I just described, which are readily available. The press could be reporting them, but they're not. You know, they could, if they weren't so cowardly, every time they reported on this fake dispute, they could say, by the way, the U.S. Government Energy Information Administration says this won't have any effect. It won't do anything for 10 years. When it does it, it'll be so small you won't even notice it. They could say that, but they don't say that. They do the he said, she said. Sorry, he said, he said. So then people are left with, okay, well, the Republicans have this plan, and, you know, the Democrats are blocking it because they're namby-pamby tree huggers. And so that jihad that the Republicans have been doing has apparently been effective, so that now you have, you know, lots of people who aren't really following things saying, well, I guess we should do that. And of course, the, you know, if you're feeling kind of desperate, somebody has a plan and somebody else says, well, that wouldn't really do much, then you'd be like, well, I'm desperate, do something. So that's the climate in which we're operating. So that's one river. Then the second river is that is part of the ridiculous aspect of the presidential campaign. Senator McCain did this campaign ad attacking Senator Obama, making fun of him for being popular, making fun of him for the fact that, you know, he went and spoke in Germany and 200,000 people came, and that he's a celebrity. And linking him, you know, making the word celebrity kind of an insult, and linking him to other quote-unquote celebrities that, according to some people, don't have a savory reputation, like Paris Hilton. So, and I assume that everybody in the listening audience knows probably better than I do who Paris Hilton is. I'm the guy that lost a bet several years ago because I didn't know who Cindy Crawford was. So, that was many years ago. But, so McCain did this ad saying, you know, Obama's like Paris Hilton. So what happened this week is that, which perhaps many people, you know, well, it's certainly the case, many people already know this, and I'll give my evidence for that in a moment. Paris Hilton did retaliation, did a rebuttal in the form of kind of a mock campaign commercial. And it was actually very funny. But if you're not one of the at least 5 million people, the last time I looked, this is like a couple days ago, the day that it came out, somebody sent me the link, I looked at it, and when I first looked at it, it had 1 million views. And then I went to bed, I woke up the next morning, it had 2 million views. The last time I looked, which is I think sometime this morning, it had 5 million views. And I was thinking, you know, talking about scale, in February, Just Foreign Policy did this video, when we did this tour with Stephen Kinzer and other experts on Iran, we had a video, and it's got 200,000 views on YouTube. And, like, I'm kind of excited about that. And, you know, people's like, well, what do you do? Oh, we're Just Foreign Policy. We had this video. It has 200,000 views on YouTube. This video about Iran. Okay, so 16 hours after they posted this thing, they had 2 million views. So, like, you know, it's a huge thing. The whole world knows about it. But one aspect of this that, which is why I wrote about this, so obviously it's this lighthearted thing, you know, making fun of McCain, making fun of the whole thing, which is wonderful. More power to her. But in the video, she says, she's sort of pretending that she's a candidate for president, she says, okay, now here's my energy policy. You know, McCain says we should have offshore drilling. Or I think she calls him the wrinkly white-haired dude. He wants to have offshore drilling. Barack says, let's have, you know, tax credits and incentives to retool Detroit. That's not what she says, but it's basically the idea. Basically, it was one of the things Obama said. You know,
reduce the dependence on foreign oil by moving to different forms of
Dependence on oil.
On oil. Sorry, that's, on
that,
oil.
I'm glad you said that, yes. Because that's another point that I would like to address.
Sure.
But let's say dependence on oil, because that's what at least part of what Obama's talking about is dependence on oil. So let's move Detroit towards clean cars, cleaner cars, electric, biofuel, hybrid, so on and so forth. So then Paris Hilton in her campaign commercial says, well, why don't we take both candidates' ideas, to do the offshore drilling now with environmental protections, blah, blah, blah. Then that will carry us over until, we do the technology thing kicks in. So that's what I wrote about.
Yes.
Because that's totally wrong, what Paris Hilton said there.
Why is that wrong, Bob?
Well, it's totally wrong because the offshore drilling is not going to carry us anywhere for any length of time. It's not a short-term solution. As I said, the Energy Information Administration said this isn't going to do anything at all. Zero for 10 years, because there isn't going to be any oil.
Because it takes 10 years to find it, to get it out of the ground.
And the oil comes out. And then even when it does, it's not a long-term solution either. Even when it does, it's not going to affect the price of gas. So it's totally wrong to say that this is a stopgap. This is like saying, okay, I called 911. Let me put some leeches on while I'm waiting for the ambulance. It's not going to help. It's going to do nothing. And you can see why. I mean, when I'm referring to Paris Hilton, I'm referring to whoever wrote the script of the video. Maybe she wrote it. Who knows? Maybe she's really, really into this stuff. But presumably she's not really, really into this stuff, or she wouldn't have made this mistake. So you have maybe two effects here. One is, the tendency of people to split the difference. Joe says this, Harry says this. Let's find the middle ground.
Why can't we all just live together?
Well, take the best of both. But also, of course, this idea is around. It's just reflecting, what people are getting out of the media and the shallow debate, which is this indication that it'll do something.
Mm-hmm.
And when, in fact, it'll do zero. So knowing full well that Paris had the microphone, that's why I wrote about this in Huffington Post, in the hope to interject some truth, a place to put truth into the dispute. And it's something that, for the last week, as this storm has happened, it's just amazing dynamic. Even today, we saw how in the run-up to the Iraq war, there was this media storm that tricked people, majority of people, enough people, to thinking that Saddam Hussein was an immediate, urgent threat and we had to act. Now we're seeing, analogous dynamic with the offshore drilling, where they, here we've had this ban. It's not a total ban, but most offshore drilling for essentially 26 years as a result of the environmental disasters that have happened in the past, and it was in the 26 was in the Reagan administration, so this wasn't like radical environmentalist Earth First thing to have a ban on offshore drilling. It was an understanding that there's a real gamble involved in doing drilling in environmentally sensitive areas. Something goes wrong, you have huge disasters for fishing, for tourism, for beaches. So they put this ban in place. So to say that, now we have an emergency, we have a crisis, we have to lift this ban, take this risk, even though it's not going to do anything, zero, about gas prices, is really irresponsible. Of course, the oil companies would love it. And there's been a big increase in campaign contributions for Republicans in the wake of this jihad. So this is, one of my projects in the last week is to see if we could counteract this jihad, get this some truth out. Fortunately, the bad news is that there are signs of some caving going on, with Senator Obama saying, we'd be willing to support this to some, you know, limited offshore drilling. It's part of an overall package to get the Republicans on board. It's part of an overall package to have a really new energy policy. The good news is that so far the Democratic leadership in Congress has stood firm on not actually even allowing a vote on lifting the ban. But I think it's a dangerous, you know, environment we're in, where in fact the Republicans that are pushing this are winning the media debate, and they're winning the media debate because the media is so awful. But you know, that means it's good opportunity for a counter jihad. We just had this action today at Representative Tim Johnson's office. It was part of hundreds of move on actions around the country, urging Representative Johnson to oppose the Republican effort to lift the ban. And as his spokesman, Phil Bloomer, pointed out, he has opposed offshore drilling in the past, as he has opposed drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So instead of all Republicans, Tim Johnson's good on this issue. But it would be even more helpful if he would, you know, speak out and push back, speak out publicly against what the Republican leadership is doing.
It seems there's two points that you're saying that the media has missed or has obfuscated to the extent that the public aren't catching. One is that there are good reasons for having a ban in place. As you say, the risk to tourism, the risk to the environment, and, or, you know, perhaps I should reverse that, the risk to environment, and then if you want to think of it in financial terms, there are industries which depend on it, people's jobs and so on. It's
yeah,
not
look
just
what happened to fishing
fluffy.
In Alaska when the Exxon Valdez spill happened. Mm-hmm. Huge fiasco.
So it's an important, in terms of protecting existing industries and existing jobs, as well as our legacy to future generations.
What's wrong with going to the beach?
Very true.
I mean, you know, we live in Champaign, Urbana, but, you know, sometimes we'd like to go to Florida. You want to go to the beach. You wouldn't want to go in there and there's just like a big oil slick.
True. And so there are good reasons for having this ban in place. The second is the only beneficiaries of removing the ban are quite some years down the road, the large oil companies to whom any profits will accrue. It will make no or essentially no difference at the pump to people who are filling up their cars.
Correct.
It will be an insignificant factor, and it will be a decade down the road when, should we have a President Obama, quite possibly will be on the way towards phasing out gasoline cars or increasingly looking towards other sources of fuel for that. Two questions to follow on. You mentioned earlier you were going to take me up on my mention of reliance on foreign oil.
Yep.
As opposed to oil. I've some guesses as to where you're going to go with that, but perhaps you should tutor me rather than my taking stabs
well,
in the dark.
Well, one reason that's on my mind is that this week there was an item on Common Dreams by Dave Lindorf, where he was talking. I mean, the overall thrust of the piece was good. He was talking about how, so another one of these ridiculous energy related things that happened last week was that Senator Obama made the point that we could, among other things, we could reduce our consumption of oil by if everybody would keep their tires inflated to the manufacturer's specification. The Republicans made a field day out of this. You know, they're like, ha, 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 ha. Obama's so out of touch. He thinks we should reduce gas consumption by inflating our tires. You know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, there was like, I don't remember the details of this, but there was some event where they were passing out, like the Republican operatives were passing out tire gauges, and the tire gauges said, you know, Barack Obama's energy plan or something like this. So, I mean, this is, you know, another example of, you know, this kind of like right-wing populist demagogic ignorance. Because the fact of the matter is that what Obama said was exactly correct. And, American Automobile Association, you know, go through the list, like the, I don't know, the motor vehicle racing, whatever. All these people, like, they all say, yeah, you should keep your tires inflated to the manufacturer specification, and that, you know, on average saves 3% of your fuel bill. So
I can tell this is true as a cyclist.
Exactly.
When I don't pump up the tires on my or the tube on my
you got to work harder.
I've got to work harder.
You can feel it in your knees.
Yeah. You know, if you've got higher pressure, if you've got it,
the wheels roll better.
They roll better. Less energy required on my part. Were I in a car, presumably less energy required from the fuel tank.
Right. So that's all exactly right. And in fact, Senator McCain in the last day or so actually backed off of this and said, well, yeah, actually, I agree. You know, you should keep your tires inflated.
That's
perfectly reasonable.
And the sort of things Obama was calling for there, those are the sort of things that during the fuel crisis of the 1970s, these are the sort of things that people were urged to do, along with, you know, lower speed limits on roads and so on, in order to make sure that people were driving at more fuel efficient speeds rather than at faster speeds, where your cars become less fuel efficient. These small sort of things do add up in the aggregate of 100 million vehicles or whatever.
Well, and this is an example of a thing that's essentially cost free. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, you should turn down a thermostat in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, clearly that involves a trade-off. You know, you might be like, oh, I'm a little cold, you know, put a sweater on, whatever. You know, maybe you might not be so comfortable depending on how much you do it. But this, like, you know, it doesn't, I mean, okay, maybe it's a quarter. Actually, there's by the Schnucks, they have a free one now. But this is the cost is very close to zero.
It's a few minutes of your time every so often in order.
Every so often.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the, you know, the context in which that's running out. So Dave Lindorf has this article saying, you know, actually, I've been doing this. I've been, you know, took the junk out of the trunk of my car that I didn't need to be there, and inflated the tires and so on and so forth. Then in the context of the article, he talks about imported Arab oil. And in defense of Dave Lindor, he does this in a context where he's talking about, you know, Republicans doing, you know, blah, blah, imported Arab oil. But when I saw that, it just reminded me that when my environmentalist friends started talking about energy independence and dependence on foreign oil, I said, this is going to end badly.
Like, this is a route to xenophobia?
You are feeding a tiger that's going to eat you. Well, I mean, for example, the whole offshore drilling thing, you know, the idea of, you know, feeding the idea that there is a crisis in our quote-unquote dependence on foreign oil, and that it's urgent that we end our quote-unquote dependence on foreign oil. I think that there is a racist aspect to it. Like, there's something, you know, there's no such thing as Arab oil. The oil is oil. Some of it comes from Arab countries. Some of it comes from Venezuela. Actually, most of our imported oil doesn't come from the Middle East.
Am I right as well in thinking along these lines that there is essentially a global market in the as a commodity?
Exactly.
The price is set, and you buy it wherever you buy it.
Exactly.
Whether the U.S. is buying more oil from the U.S. or selling the oil elsewhere and having to import.
Right. So what these people are, if you were saying, and, you know, depending on what they mean, maybe they say lessen to finesse it.
Mm-hmm.
But ending dependence on foreign oil would mean that you have to, you know, clearly the U.S. consumption is now greater than U.S. production. So you'd have to increase production or decrease consumption or both. And there's absolutely no humanly possible way to get there by increasing production. There's just, I mean, it's not even close. Reducing consumption, if you had really radical conservation and really radical conversion, maybe you could do that in the long term. But that's a pretty tall hill to climb. And it's a and it's not at all clear that you should set this as a goal, given that you're, you know, essentially empowering people to do bad things in the guise of energy independence, like offshore drilling, creating the market for that, as well as feeding the notion that, you know, why shouldn't we, if we're going to end our dependence on foreign oil, why shouldn't we end our dependence on foreign food? What's special about oil? Why shouldn't we end our dependence on foreign clothes? So I think this notion, and it kind of feeds into the notion of like something bad, you know, the Arabs have this evil leverage on us that they're going to, you know, hurt us with. And if anything, you know, I feel safer knowing that there's some external leverage on the United States in the form of the price of oil. I mean, arguably, one of the reasons that we haven't started a war with Iran yet is that is what it would do to the price of oil. It's one of the things holding the U.S. back. And on the other hand, as I argued in my riposte to Paris Hilton and elsewhere, one of the things that we could actually do if we wanted to lower the price of oil would be to lift the sanctions on Iran, which are currently contributing to the high price. If the sanctions were lifted, there were international cooperation in Iran's oil industry, they could arguably increase production by 1 to 2 million barrels a day. That would be 5 to 10 times the projected peak of McCain's offshore drilling.
A decade from now.
Yeah, that would be a decade from now. Yeah, and the arguably the increase in Iranian production could happen in a few years. Mm-hmm. So it would be 5 to 10 times more, and it would be much sooner, and it wouldn't threaten our fisheries and tourism and beaches. So why aren't we even, like, why isn't that part of the mix? I mean, we're talking about having a comprehensive strategy involving everything. Well, how about negotiating a deal with Iran that leads to an increase in Iranian production? That would actually do something to lower the price of gas. Not to mention, of course, you know, as was pointed out in a June paper by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, if the United States had simply continued to gradually increase fuel efficiency standards, auto fuel efficiency standards after 1985, at just a quarter of the annual level that they had been doing in the previous 5-year period, 80 to 85, they had continued doing that from 1985 instead of leaving them virtually the same, it would have saved the equivalent of 3.3 billion barrels a day in 2008 production. So that would be 16 times the effect of McCain's offshore drilling. All that oil was brought on the market. So there's actually lots of stuff that we could do that would be easier, that would have less downside, that would have a much bigger effect, that would happen arguably quicker than this ridiculous proposal for offshore drilling, including talking to Iran, which we could do immediately. You know, like right now, if we wanted, we could have a deal with Iran. It would be real negotiation. It wouldn't be Iran accepting the U.S. position. It would be some kind of middle ground, like the Pickering proposal, where we say, okay, you can have enrichment of uranium in Iran, but there has to be full international control. You get that, if you had a deal like that, you lift the sanctions, capital would come flying into the country. Oil companies would love to get back. The Western oil companies would love to get back into Iran. And arguably, you'd see a dramatic increase in production there.
And for you know, the standard line from capitalists so often is that increased market interaction, increased interdependency in economic terms reduces essentially national security risks. That's usually the line that you hear for, as they put it, opening up markets. So in this case, where you're talking about highly tense situations, surely this would be something that, you know, following common logic,
absolutely,
right, would lead in that direction. I want to follow up, you know the 2 points you mentioned there about increasing efficiency standards. You know, had we increased efficiency standards as we were doing, had we, you know, had that continued, huge savings that could have been made. You said 16 times what McCain is predicting, right, 10 years from now.
200,000 barrels a day versus 3.3 million barrels a day.
Mm-hmm. Were we to, were the U.S. to reduce sanctions on Iran, or with the U.N. reduce sanctions on Iran and prompt investment there, you would also have something that would be several multiples of the proposal. What strikes me when comparing that to Obama's thing about fuel or about air pressure and so on, which, as we said, you know, defended, it is a genuine thing, but it's something that concerns me, and I know concerns other commentators about much of Obama's rhetoric, is a concentration on what can happen, you know, on what individuals should be doing, and often, at least in his own public rhetoric, perhaps not in the detail of his policy plans, sidestepping the structural changes that, you know, the stuff that government can do through regulation and through essentially public, you know, the importance of public policy in exerting huge change in our society, preferring instead the emphasis on the failings or you know, the importance of the individual.
I take your point, but let me say two things about that. I mean, and insofar as it's true, I totally agree. But let me say two things about that. First, it's not true. That's just, you know, one thing that he said. He said other things that are structural and do point to government policy, like, for example, saying that it should be the policy of the U.S. government to promote the retooling of the U.S. auto industry to produce different kind of cars. Mm. That's a structural change that should take place. But the second thing that I would point out is that, in fact, there is not a clean distinction between talking about issues of individual behavior and talking about government policy. One of the things that government policy can do and does do is promote changes in behavior that are pro-social. So, for example, you know, when I was a child, lots of people didn't wear seatbelts. I'm 43 years old tomorrow. Lots of people didn't wear seatbelts. I can remember, for example, driving, you know, with my mother. I think it's too late for her to be turned into the Child Protection Agency. So, like, my mother's driving the car. I'm sitting in the passenger seat. And I didn't have a seatbelt on. And if my mother made a short stop, she would throw her arm out and, you know, keep me from going into the dashboard. And there was a cultural change in the United States, which isn't 100%. Everybody doesn't always wear the seatbelt. But there was a cultural change in the United States where now just a whole lot more people wear seatbelts. And that came partly through public education and seatbelt laws and, you know, people's actions and so on. And that's obviously a huge plus in terms of auto safety. Again, I can remember when, you know, there was a concerted campaign to make drunk driving socially unacceptable. And it's still the case, obviously, that there's drunk driving and there's terrible accidents and so on and so forth. But I can tell you from my own personal experience that there has been a sea change in public attitude. So now, coming back to the point about choice. Well, and in fact, the thermostat example, I remember when I'm old enough to remember when Jimmy Carter, you know, gave his speech from the White House with the sweater and talked about the thermostats. We turned down the thermostat in our house, and a lot of other people did too. So that doesn't count for zero. I mean, government leadership and like use of condoms, you know, TV ads promoting condom use, that's a government policy, you know, or bus stop ads promoting condom use. That's a government policy that's saying, yeah, we're going to have a policy of encouraging people to use condoms in order to lessen the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases, lessen transmission of HIV/AIDS. That's part of public health. That's government policy. So individual behavior is not a separate thing from government policy. If the U.S. government decided among its menu of things, and it's sensible to have a menu of things. Among its menu of things, to say, okay, one of the things we're going to do is to is to promote, you know, try to get people to have their tires inflated to the manufacturer's specification. You could do that. It's not just a question of saying, well, you know, it's your own fault, stupid people. Why don't you behave differently? You could have government policies to encourage that. Give out free tire gauges. Why not?
The Republicans already are.
Yeah. And you know, why not? You do other things to incentivize good behavior. I mean, like, even in the crummy student health insurance policy at the university, there is a discrimination between, there's a bias in the policy to encourage you to do certain kinds of preventative things, like free teeth cleaning once a semester or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, somebody instituted that policy. That's a forward-looking policy. I mean, after all, it's not an emergency medical procedure. You could get by without it. You could go, you know, a couple years without having your teeth cleaned, and, you know, you wouldn't die. But it's good social policy to promote preventative medicine, and that's why. And we need 10 times as much. But even now, mm-hmm. under our totally messed up system, you already have that represented. So if someone would say, we could have better dental hygiene if people had their teeth cleaned more often, that's not just a question of individual behavior, individual choice. That's something that you can socially promote. And, you know, it's like well understood all over the world that this is part of the function of government is to promote pro-social social behaviors.
So social advocacy, public health is perhaps the best known example, but there you're saying that it fits in as part of a broader palette of tools of government.
Absolutely. Why wouldn't you do that?
Mm-hmm. On the other question that came to mind on the issue of energy is I have seen some commentary in the past week saying that while retooling Detroit has been is part of Obama's or has previously been part of its, you know, manifesto on energy, that it's something that has been downplayed in recent weeks. I'm not sure if you would agree with that that interpretation. And also, do you see retooling? How realistic is it to look for, as you say, a retooling of Detroit?
Well, first of all, you know, I don't really have a sense of the downplaying. To me, it seemed like an uplaying, mm-hmm. based in the news that I saw. That seemed like the Obama campaign was giving that promise.
I may be reading more negative.
So, but I don't know. I can't really judge, because until recently, it wasn't an issue that I was following closely. So it may be the case. I don't know. But about how realistic is to retool Detroit? In a way, I think it's very realistic, because the fact of the matter is that even if the government didn't do anything, the economic incentives in the marketplace have just changed very dramatically. The demand for these gas-guzzling cars has dropped through the floor. You know, for years, environmentalists and other people were inveighing against SUVs to no avail. Now that the price of gas is $4 a gallon, people are like, you know, they don't want to drive a vehicle that gets 10 miles to the gallon or 12 miles to the gallon. And so the car companies can't sell these cars. People that have them don't want to drive them. They try to sell them, can hardly get any money for them. So the market has changed, and so long as gas remains anything near its current level, there is a huge incentive, actually, for people to purchase and for companies to manufacture cars that are much more fuel efficient. But there's no reason just to sort of sit back and say, okay, well, let the market do that, because there's a big shift that needs to take place. And it's far from obvious that the auto companies, which in the past, you know, not been very enlightened, will necessarily be enlightened now. You know, they could say, okay, well, let's just give up making cars. You know, let's just move all production overseas. So it's good for the government to be proactive and try to facilitate the transition.
Mm-hmm. And again, in some of the commentary I've seen, an emphasis on, you know, if oil dependence is to be lessened, cars are very much one of the places where that needs to happen, being such a large portion of the oil usage in the United States.
Yes. And, of course, a smart policy would look at everything and make changes. You know, gasoline-powered lawnmowers are tremendously fuel inefficient. Very little standards there. So, you know, a smart government policy would look down the list and say, what can we have? What's having the most impact now? Where can we get the most change for the smallest amount of government investment? But absolutely, particularly given the way that Americans live compared to Europe, we're much more spread out.
That's something that's important, I think, in thinking about the sort of changes that are feasible. You talked about, you know, when setting public policy, the importance of looking at what investment is needed versus what change do you get out the far side. And some of the differences between the US and Europe are the result of decades of structure, you know, infrastructure building or infrastructural deficit.
Absolutely.
In terms of large
transit
suburbs,
highways,
exactly.
Yeah.
The fact that so many cities are so spread out, and this is something in Ireland we're dealing with increasingly, where so much industrial investment has been based around Dublin, that we've got people, you know, living one side of Dublin in a suburb, working in a suburb the other side of Dublin, and you know, so you know, automobile being the only feasible way for many people to commute. It's difficult when, you know, if you've got people living in one suburb of Chicago and working in another, it's difficult to plan bus routes that will serve them. It's difficult to put in, if somebody wants to, you know, if it's arterial, if you want to go from, you know, from a suburb to the downtown, that's easier.
Or even if you want to go from the south side of Chicago to the northwest,
mm-hmm.
It's not convenient.
Yeah. Well, you know, given the way Chicago's transit is set up, it's difficult to go from anywhere to anywhere.
Right.
But it's easy
to go downtown.
Sure, and it leads me to think that some of the changes that might be desirable in terms of thinking about reducing reliance on automobiles, putting other options in place, maybe long-term solutions. There's stuff you can do in the short term, there's investment you can make for the medium term, but some of the things in terms of changing urban design and urban layout, which could conceivably, you know, reduce gasoline needs quite a bit, are not the sort of things that can easily be accomplished in the short to medium term.
It's true, but on the other hand, it's really striking to see how, you know, all the stuff that's been ignored for years is on the table now that gas is $4 a gallon. So everything that people were talking about, you know, like pro-density and transit-oriented development, all these kind of, you know, urban planning, environmental stuff, that's been around for years and people have talked about and, you know, tried to implement to some degree. Now, you know, it's like on the front page, like mm-hmm. how people are planning, for example, in the Washington area, where there's huge issues of sprawl and heavy pressure for new policies, as, you know, has been for a while, but massively jacked up by the change in price. So, I mean, I think it's really telling, because these things, if it weren't for stupid politics and stupid government policy, these changes could have been implemented much more fully implemented years ago. But
the friction of the system has only been overcome now that you've got $4 gas.
Look at the fuel standards. Imagine that the that increases in fuel efficiency had been implemented gradually after 1985, then you wouldn't have this tremendous shock that people are facing today. But the main reason that they weren't, I mean, there were attempts in Congress all these years to increase the standards, but they were blocked by the auto industry lobby and said, oh, this is too expensive. We can't change. So now, you know, people are paying the price of the failure of government policy in the past.
Mm-hmm. I had a question to slip my mind. I was going to give an example locally of changes in policy or development of policy, which is, of course, the fact that the city of Champaign has announced a multi-year plan to roll out bike lanes in its on some of its major artery routes in order to facilitate greater bicycle usage in the city, something that has not been uniformly the case in the past, but that I think reflects perhaps a greater call from members of the public for bicycles to be seen as part of the transit mix in the city. And of course, locally here at the Independent Media Center, many people will know, some may not, we now have a bicycle co-op where people are, you know, repairing and providing a bicycles to members of the public. So there are various different things that are, you know, where different things are coming together to have a greater priority placed on bicycles and other forms of what would be seen, I suppose, as alternative modes of transit being facilitated in public policy and elsewhere.
I was just thinking as I rode my bicycle here today, what a convenient place the IMC is to ride your bike to, because there's this wonderful railing out in front of the building that's a legacy of it being a post office. And I don't know why, whenever this building was built, somebody thought that there should be this big railing across the front of the building to, I guess, to channel you to go up, walk up the stairs in front of the door. But as a result of which, there's all these great places to park your bike, which isn't true everywhere around town. So, for example, if you go to the coffee shop at Lincoln in Oregon, there's no place to park your bike. It's kind of annoying. And it is in a town like Champaign-Urbana, I mean, it's a comparative advantage, which I suppose, you know, given that the Champaign City Council is not the most enlightened public body in the world, it's something, you know, it's hard to for Champaign-Urbana to have its own ballet company, but it's relatively easy to have a good system of making it easy to use a bicycle there compared to a place like Chicago, for example, where, you know, you're depending on where you need to go, you'd be taking your life in your hands. I mean, Champaign, it's the case now, unfortunately, that depending on your route, you are taking your life in your hands. One of my colleagues, when I worked at Wolfram Research, was killed riding his bicycle during rush hour in Champaign. So I'm all for it. It's obviously a Pareto improvement, as the economists would say. It's obviously more socially efficient. There's clearly lots of people, just like there's lots of people who would belong to a union if they could, there's lots of people who would use bicycles as a form of transportation if they felt safe riding on the street doing it. And if there were more bike lanes, people would feel more safe.
Bob, 2 or 3 minutes left on the show. Moving away from energy, we usually concentrate on issues of international policy and international affairs. Any one or two items that have occurred in the past week that people should be aware of or should keep on the radar?
One thing I thought was striking was that Human Rights Watch this week came out with a criticism of Israeli announcements of expansion of settlements in the occupied territories. And they called on the United States government to, first of all, oppose this, but secondly, to cut U.S. aid to Israel by a corresponding amount to the expenditure on new settlements. So it'll be interesting to see if Human Rights Watch follows up with that, you know, maybe some members of Congress be willing to speak up on this very, very modest proposal. Another interesting thing that happened this week was a report in the British newspaper The Independent, which pointed out that one of the Israeli candidates for Prime Minister, Shaul Mofaz, when he was chief of staff of the military during the Second Intifada, at one point told military commanders that he wanted to see 70 Palestinian deaths a day. And somebody actually, you know, kind of tried to follow him up on this. This is the same guy who's been regularly driving oil markets wild by threatening to attack Iran. So hopefully this guy doesn't become the next Israeli prime minister. But none of this has appeared in the U.S. press yet.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the issue of who will become the next Israeli prime minister is a live issue at the moment.
Well, given the current prime minister, Mr. Olmert, has announced his intention to resign.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that people should watch for in the weeks to come?
The press coverage on Latin America continues to be awful. There was an interesting article in the Washington Post on the referendum coming up in Bolivia. This is part of the Bolivian government's attempts to solve the political tensions coming from the opposition in the richer areas, the more European and richer areas of the country, to their national reform agenda. So the national government called the question by saying, okay, let's have some recall referenda. And the President Morales, will stand, but the governors will also have to stand. So that referendum is coming up this Sunday. President Morales is expected to win. Some of the governors, but not all the governors, are expected to win.
Okay, Bob, thank you very much. We've come to the end of our show for today. Thank you very much for listening. A Critical Ear presents news and commentary about a range of topical issues, from international affairs to the labor movement. It is produced and broadcast from the studios of WRFU in Urbana, Illinois. Our website includes show archives and further discussion of topics discussed on air. For more information, go to acriticalear.info or contact us by email at show@acriticalear.info. Twitter updates at @acriticalear. Views expressed on A Critical Ear are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, or Urbana Socialist Forum. WRFU LP Urbana on 104.5 FM, your community radio station.